Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I'm not sure I've ever put it quite this plainly before, but what the heck with this economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Thursday, today the 24th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You could make a case that stronger language than what the heck is called for when talking about this economy. But hey, we're a family program. Here's what I mean, though. We've got the final reading on first quarter gross domestic product this morning, 6.4% growth, which is, I think the technical term is a lot. And then we heard that durable goods orders, big stuff like cars and appliances and factory machines, was up more than 2% last month. But then you turn the statistical page to find out that first-time jobless claims barely budged last week, still above 400,000. Yes, way better than during the thick of it, but still double-ish of what it was in the before times. And there are still almost 14.8 million Americans getting unemployment checks week after week, state or federal, regular or extended. So, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the what the heck desk today.
If you're an economist, maybe it makes sense that growth is surging while unemployment is still rampant and millions can't pay the rent. But if you're in this economy,
it's understandable that those without work are somewhat confused.
That's Joe Bruswellis at RSM Consulting.
They're hearing reports of perhaps the economy expanding by 10% this quarter, yet jobless claims appear to have stalled out.
With 11 million people still on federal emergency pandemic unemployment.
We're learning a lot more about the depth and breadth of the American labor market, just how many people are out of work. And that's because we expanded those unemployment insurance benefits to non-traditional workers or gig workers.
Confidence is rising strongly for middle-income Americans, those earning $50,000 to $100,000 a year, says John Lear at Morning Consult. He points to service workers that are getting rehired in restaurants, health and personal care, transportation. But for those lower-income Americans whose government relief payments and jobless benefits are running out,
the shadow of the pandemic is going to be extremely long. People who lost their jobs have lost contact with their prior employer. Potentially their prior employer is out of business. They all of a sudden right now are trying to figure out, how can I find a job?
Even though jobs are available, many offering hiring bonuses. Anne Elizabeth Conkle is with Indeed, a current Marketplace underwriter.
Employers are really looking for workers. As of June 18th, job postings on Indeed were up 30.5% compared to their pre-pandemic baseline.
But she says for many, there are still barriers to taking work, like fear of getting COVID and lack of affordable childcare, if it's even available. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
At the risk of overusing an already overused phrase, we might be headed into Infrastructure Week, or more realistically, a hot infrastructure summer. Yes, a bipartisan group of senators and the White House say they have a deal. No, it's not clear how it's going to be funded. And yes, that means the hard part is still to come. Wall Street today, traders did love them. Some infrastructure talk, I'll tell you what. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The House Judiciary Committee was up late last night into the wee small hours of this morning, in point of fact, working their way through a whole slew of bills that are going to take on big tech. We're talking Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple here mostly. If these bills do become law, still not a sure thing, we should say, it would be the biggest expansion of antitrust in this economy in decades. So we got Margaret Harding McGill on the phone to break down what is going on. She's a tech policy reporter at Axios. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So in a nutshell, what would these bills do to these big tech companies?
These bills would significantly alter the practices and in some cases break up the tech companies.
That was a short sentence that says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, these bills would do a lot. They would, for instance, stop Facebook from acquiring other companies for the most part, or perhaps say Amazon, you can no longer sell Amazon Basics on your platform. They would also say, Google, you can't really preference your YouTube in your search results. There's a lot of changes that these bills would force on these companies if they are made into law.
There is a word here that I'm going to use that we haven't heard a lot, and then I want you to tell me where these sides are coming from. This is a bipartisan bill, but each side of the aisle has distinctly different motivations.
Yes, I think that's true. And it was so interesting to see where some of the breakdowns were in the markup, because there are Democrats who oppose this legislation and Republicans who support it. You have Republicans who are concerned about the power of big tech platforms because of what they say is their ability to censor conservative voices. And so you have some Republicans like Ken Buck from Colorado who believe the way to solve that issue is to have more competition with the tech platforms. Jim Jordan from Ohio, the ranking member of the full Judiciary Committee, does not believe that these bills would accomplish that. He argues that they're giving too much power to Biden bureaucrats, his words, not mine, and would not address the problem of censorship.
You know, not to pick on Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, but every time the topic of regulation comes out, either Zuckerberg or the Facebook spokesperson says, look, we welcome regulation. In essence, they say, please regulate us because we're not sure how to do it ourselves, which I think has been demonstrated by their behavior in real life. Do you suppose this is what Mr. Zuckerberg had in mind?
Definitely not. Facebook put out a pretty tough statement ahead of the bills saying that they aren't the solution that consumers want. They are a poison pill for America's tech industry at a time our economy can least afford it. So there is none of this, yes, we need to be regulated, just let us know what you want to do. In this case, they're fighting against these pretty hard.
Let me take you down another little rabbit hole here in the little bit of time we have left. You know, if this does lead to the breakup of some of these companies, and we should be clear here, these bills are geared at like four, maybe five companies in this entire economy. If this bill says, listen, you got to break up and sell off some component parts, if Facebook had to spin off Instagram or Google had to spin off YouTube, there would be more value created, right?
That's the argument that the chairman of the antitrust subcommittee makes, David Cicilline. He says that this would be beneficial because there would be more companies and more competition.
Spitball it for me. You think this happens or are we a long way from anywhere?
Love to predict what Congress will do, but I do think it makes it through the House. But I don't know if it makes it through the Senate. I'm very dubious about that.
Fair enough. Margaret Harding McGill, she's a tech policy reporter at Axios, talking about the move to regulate some of these big tech companies in this economy right now. Margaret, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the conversation.
We got a survey from the bosses here at Marketplace the other day wanting to know how we're feeling about coming back to the office, or would we even want to? But it's not just us, and it's not just coming back to the office. Kickstarter says it's going to be experimenting with a four-day work week next year, paying employees the same to work fewer days. The first company, in fact, to sign on to a new national campaign aiming to make the four-day work week an actual thing. The moral of the story is that the pandemic has provided an opening for companies to really rethink how work gets done by some workers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino's on that one.
The five-day work week has come to feel like a law of nature, but that was once a new idea too, says John Leland, a VP at Kickstarter who's leading the new campaign for a shorter work week.
We had centuries of reducing working hours, and then we've been locked at 40 hours a week.
But he says the pandemic could be a tipping point.
Everything's much more in flux right now.
Being away from the office and business as usual has given many workers a newfound appreciation for flexibility.
We've had people come to us who have taken a pay cut, but would rather be here with the sort of work-life balance that they're going to get.
Nicole Miller works in human resources at social media app Buffer, which moved to a four-day week during the pandemic as an experiment. At the end of the year, they found productivity remained about the same and morale seemed to improve. A shortened work week could become more common in industries where competition for talent is intense, says Alex Pang, author of the book Shorter, Work Better, Smarter, and Less.
Time is going to be the new catered lunch or, you know, in-house masseur.
But like those luxuries, it could become one more benefit for the most privileged workers, says Dean Baker, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
If you see a situation where white-collar workers have all this flexibility, they can be with their family, they can do other things, whereas blue-collar workers are stuck 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. I mean, it's already bad, but you don't want to see that get worse.
He says it would probably take putting a shorter work week into law to spread the benefit more evenly through the economy. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Visa, the credit card conglomerate, says it's going to spend more than $2 billion to buy a Swedish fintech company. Financial technology is what fintech means. Anyway, it's a company called Tink. Tink, as it happens, brands itself as Europe's leading open banking platform. And open banking is what exactly? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on that one.
Okay, so open banking is the sharing of your personal banking data with a third party. With your consent, an app gets to see your bank account activity, the size of your direct deposits.
You know, the number of transactions and who did the customer transact with, how much they paid for coffee, and so on and so forth.
That's Marco Sahadiadis, a fintech professor at the University of Manchester in the UK. Now, these third-party apps, which you may already be using, offer all sorts of things in return. Take Venmo, which allows you to send money to friends, or a budgeting app like Mint, which will analyze your spending history. Other third-party platforms like the online lender Bluevine are meant for small business owners. Sabrina Howell teaches finance at NYU's Stern School of Business.
The Bluevine might want to access, you know, bank information in order to understand how risky a potential borrower is.
Often, third-party apps rely on fourth parties, companies that build the technology that lets them connect to banks. That's what Visa's acquisition, Tink, does. There is risk to the open banking concept.
By providing the authentication, the login information to these third parties, you know, we open ourselves up to many different avenues for hacking and security breaches.
It really depends on which apps you use and what security measures they take. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
So here's what you ought to do. You ought to listen to David Brancaccio and the team on the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your business and economic day. Coming up.
It's often not documented.
How do you keep track of your lived experiences? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 322 points today, 0.9%. Closed at 34,196 did the blue chips. The NASDAQ was up 97 points, about 0.6%, 14,369. The S&P 500 added 24.5%, 42.66. Construction-related stocks gained as President Biden reached that agreement with a bipartisan group of senators on an infrastructure spending deal. The infrastructure is taken care of. The spending is not, key point. Heavy machinery manufacturer Caterpillar inched up 2.5%. Caterpillar inched. Get it? Oh, I like that. Deere & Company bucked up 0.8%. Steel company Nucor buffed up 1.9%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, you go out these days, the economy is starting to look, kind of normal, right? Might look it, does not feel it, especially for a whole lot of small restaurants. Many of them are short-staffed, yes, but also they are still dealing with all the lost revenue and challenges financially of the past year and a half or so. Casa Lula is one of them. It's a wine and cheese bar in New York City. And we got Brian Kaiser on the phone the other day. He's the general manager, also the owner. And I asked him why, after being closed for most of the pandemic, he has chosen next week to open back up.
Well, there's some conflicting motivations. One, there's a part of me that wants to get open as soon as possible. But our location is in Hell's Kitchen. So we're really reliant on theaters and Midtown office workers. And those are two groups that are not back, and I don't think will be until the fall.
Well, then you have to help me out with this, right? Because if you're opening July 1, but your customer base isn't there, it's going to be and Broadway comes back, I think, September early-ish.
September 14th.
Yeah. It's going to be a long couple of months, man.
I am worried that it's going to be a long couple of months. And the thing that would make those couple of months survivable for us is the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, mm-hmm. which I'm not confident that we are going to get that until they add more money to the fund. And I'm really concerned that they're not going to move fast enough for it to actually help us.
Well, so let me ask you this. And I get this. This was really hard for you to work through. But why not just shut it down? When you realize you had to be closed the whole time, why not just say, you know what, we're not going to make this work. And it's a tragedy for me and my workers. And this is my dream, but I can't have it now.
I have to tell you, I decided to shut it down permanently multiple times over the last year.
Yeah.
I have a good landlord, so that with PPP money, some of which could go to rent, and with him making some compromises, we were able to stay in the space. And then when the RRF passed, then it was suddenly hope that, okay, we're going to get enough money that we can finally get reopened. So we keep getting hope, and then it feels like it's just out of our grasp.
How many people count on you for their employment? I mean, like in the before times, how many people did you have working for you?
15 employees.
And now I'm sure they are scattered to the wind. So, you know, you got a week till you reopen. What you going to do?
Well, I'm very lucky in that my kitchen staff is either back or willing to come back. Wait staff is a little harder. I'm doing things like adding touchless ordering, but that's not really the way I want to run my business.
Just because it's in the conversation, are you raising pay? Are you offering, you know, better pay than you were before?
Yeah, I think restaurants have to. And actually, the people that I've talked to in the business who are having trouble finding employees are the ones who are playing by the old rules. So my plan is to stop paying servers the sub-minimum wage that's allowed for tipped employees and spread tips around amongst more of the staff and hopefully be able to create a place where everybody's making a living wage and hopefully better than that. But it's not going to be cheap.
Yeah. You got a plan B? I mean, you were making some plans during the pandemic, right?
Yeah. Back last fall when I was feeling that it was highly unlikely that the restaurant would get open again, I applied to several graduate schools in public health policy. And so, ironically, on the day that we found out that the Restaurant Revitalization Fund was oversubscribed, I also got accepted to Georgetown's graduate school. So I had to defer. And So I'm still holding out hope that the SBA and Congress will act quickly and add more funds to the RRF. But if they don't act quickly, restaurants like mine are going to just run out of time.
Brian Kaiser, he runs a place. He runs it for now. We'll see what happens in a number of weeks and months. He runs a place in Manhattan called Casa Lula. It's a wine and cheese bar. Brian, thanks a lot. Best of luck to you. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Kay. I appreciate it.
Okay, here's the second part, in a way, of Mitchell's story that we started with today about what the heck with this economy right now. Lots of really good signs, but still a high unemployment and a record number of job openings. We've done a lot of reporting on what businesses are going to have to do to get new workers, especially in restaurant and leisure. Better conditions is what they're looking for. Also, better pay. But once people are on payroll, it's not all sunshine and light. You know, you got to train a big pool of new employees, some of whom may have little or no experience, and you got to train them quickly and all at once, too. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked at how some companies are tackling this onslaught of onboarding.
It's the first day of orientation at the Conrad, a five-star Hilton hotel in Lower Manhattan. All the hallmarks of welcome to your new job are here. Coffee and donuts at the back, PowerPoint presentation at the front. A group of eight new hires is being quizzed on what-if scenarios.
Okay, gentlemen, group one. So we have a guest. You encounter them in the hallway. They're upset. Their room hasn't been cleaned all day. How do we use our heart model to make it right for the guest?
First, we apologize to the guest. Heartfelt sincerely.
Up to 75% of Hilton employees were furloughed during the pandemic. But since the beginning of the year, the company's hired 12,000 workers, mostly in food service and housekeeping. And they're still looking for more. All of them go through a two-week training course like this one, even those returning from furlough, because hospitality has changed.
How's the traffic been? A little stressful?
Yeah.
Well, when you consider now that 70% of our guests arrive in their car, we need to give them a little leeway and empathize with them.
Marlene Pointer is this hotel's general manager. She says when you lump together high customer expectations, constantly changing COVID cleaning protocols, and lots of new staff, service is inevitably going to suffer.
Things are a little bit slower because everybody's trying to get back into the groove. I think moving forward, the public will be less forgiving.
This is why Hilton is spending so much time on training. And of course, time is money. A survey from Training Magazine says it costs the company on average $1,200 to train each worker. And that doesn't even include everything an employer loses when an employee leaves, which is happening more often in this labor market. Dorothy Leonard is a professor at Harvard Business School and researches institutional knowledge.
It's often not documented, but is in the heads and sometimes the hands of people who have worked in that business for decades.
An example of this is, say, a bartender who knows a regular customer so well they plunk down their drink of choice before they even order.
That kind of knowledge, much of which is tacit, it's not written down, it's not documented, is difficult to capture and transfer to new hires.
For experienced employees, work becomes intuitive. So intuitive that they're often not able to articulate how or why they do something the way they do. It's why she says new workers need to work hand in hand with experienced employees. That's difficult now in industries where businesses are practically starting their workforce from scratch. Geraldine Maldonado oversees management of seven Chipotles in New York City. She says the company is combating the knowledge shortage with something they call certified training restaurants.
That means that everyone in that restaurant is trained to be able to, you know, train other people.
Every new hire is paired with a certified training employee, which is pretty crazy if you think about it, because right now Chipotle is hiring 20,000 workers.
You know, it is a little bit overwhelming, but I that is where we can go back and fall back on the tools that we have here.
Like videos on how to make guacamole.
So Chipotle, we don't want it too mashed up. We like a little bit of chunks, right? So it's like a mixture, 50-50 mixture of creamy and chunks.
And the how-to videos and workshops don't stop after employees are hired. Back at the Conrad Hotel, Marlene Pointer says the pandemic has made workers more worried about job progression.
They were so concerned that their careers would stall and that they've lost 18 months.
Hilton recently started a three-month training program that teaches employees business skills like marketing and revenue. Because in a tight labor market, companies can't afford to watch all that hard-earned institutional knowledge get scooped up by someone else. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I saw this in Quartz, some research due out later this summer in the journal Social Science and Medicine, showing that during the early days of the pandemic, January to August of last year specifically, 43% of the crowdfunding campaigns on GoFundMe got zero donations. During the before times, Just 3.5% of those campaigns came up empty. Lots of reasons for that, the researchers say. But as the CEO of GoFundMe has said on this program twice in the past 18 months, crowdfunding is not supposed to be the social safety net, you know. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. You want pent-up demand? We got some pent-up demand and then some, actually. Bank of America was out with a research note today about clothing purchases. We are buying more than we were last year at this time, which makes total sense. We are also, though, buying more clothes, 35% more, B of A says. Dollars spent is the metric. Anyway, 35% more than we were 2 years ago. Go figure that one out. How many clothes can you wear? I don't know. All right. Anyway, Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Cardant, the Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.